Welcome to Acre Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and today's podcast is with Phil Keeble. Phil is a former Hunter, F4 and Tornado F3 pilot. In this episode, he mainly talks about flying in the Hunter, but also shares some great stories, such as flying against the F-14s. So please enjoy and don't forget to subscribe.
I've been interested in aviation since I was a small boy. My dad used to take me to the beach at West Wittering, down on the south coast of England. And while I was there, the Black Arrows with the Hunters used to come and practice off the beach with their 12 ships and 9 ships and things like that. And I used to watch them doing the loops and amazing stuff. And I thought to myself then, yes, that's what I want to do. That was my heart's desire. Also, my father was in the Air Force. He flew Catalinas and Wellingtons in the war, and he used to tell me stories that he got up to. And so really, I've always been infused with the desire to be a part of the Air Force and to go flying. And then when I passed my 11 plus, which is going back a little bit now, as a treat, I was given a flight from Eastleigh Airport in Hampshire, Southampton, in a de Havilland Rapide. And from there on, I was just hooked, absolutely hooked. So I joined the Air Cadets and flew the Chipmunk at Hamburg. And then when I got to 16, I was at grammar school in Hampshire, and I decided to apply to the Air Force for a scholarship to Cramall. Now, in their wisdom, they decided that I wasn't the right material, so they said no, but you can come back in 2 years. So I had 2 years to fill, basically. So I joined the Southern Gas Board as a chemist in Poole Gas Works, and after about 3 hours of that, I realised this was not going to be my future. So I did 6 months while I looked for another job, and I decided that I wanted something that was similar to the military but not quite, so I joined the police force. I joined the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Police Force, which I really enjoyed. I thought it was a great career. But I still wanted to fly. That was still, and I wanted to travel as well. Those two things were impossible in the police. So I was at Eastleigh Technical College doing day release, and I went downtown Southampton, and I was passing the RAF recruiting office. So I walked in and I spoke to the recruiting sergeant, and he said, "What can I do for you?" So I said, "I'd like to become an RAF policeman." So, because I always fancied a great big dog to protect me, you know. So he said, "Have you got any O-levels?" I said, "Yeah, I've got 5. He said, "Have you got maths and English?" I said, "Yes, I've got maths and English." He said, "Have you got any science subjects?" I said, "Yeah, I've got 3. He said, "Do you want to be a pilot?" So I said, "Yeah, okay." And that was as easy as that. He gave me the forms, I filled them in. I went to Biggin Hill for a second time, which was a lot easier than the first time because I knew what was going to happen. And also I'd had the 18 months experience in the police. So when they asked me about my views on life and interesting things that had happened, I was able to, you know, spin a few stories. And I got selected, and I joined the Air Force in November 65. And the rest of it is here we are today, some 3 centuries later.
When you first joined the RAF, what was your training like for yourself?
Training? I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was with a great bunch of blokes, and that always helps a lot. If you've got your buddies to support you in, because you're going to go through tough times and good times, and you know, if you can all go down to the bar and have a beer and chat about it afterwards, and just basically, you know, just to relax a bit, that helps a lot. I did have one very big weakness, which was maths. I don't know how I passed my maths O level, but I did, and so I was recoursed from the first 5 weeks of square bashing because I failed the maths exam. Went on to pass it the second time, but that made me super fit because, you know, we were doing like every morning we were doing long runs and PT and all that stuff. Then we went on to the leadership phase, which I really enjoyed, tromping around hills and swimming in rivers. And, you know, in fact, I think secretly underneath there's a bit of cabbage in me, a little bit of army in me, you know, because I've always enjoyed firing guns and all that sort of stuff as well. So, and then we went on to the final 5-6 weeks, which again was academics, and guess what? I failed them a second time. So instead of doing 15 weeks, I think I did 25, 26 weeks. But I didn't mind it. It was down in South Surrey in the Cotswolds, which was a marvellous place to be, marvellous place. So once we'd got our commission, then obviously a lot of us who hadn't flown properly, I mean PPL type properly, were stayed on to fly on the Chipmunk primary flying squadron. So, and that was another 5 weeks of flying the Chipmunk, learning the basics, vector controls, handling, spinning, stalling, aerobatics. And that was just unbelievable, because it was sort of flying in the morning and then either cream teas down in some nice little cafe in the Cotswolds in the afternoon, or out to the pub for a couple of pints and chicken in the basket in the evening. So for me, I mean, I was a square peg in a square hole. I just adored the Air Force, and I wouldn't have wanted to do anything else, as it happens. And then from there, I got through that quite successfully. Then I went to RAF Syston and flew the Jet Provost 3, which was my first experience of a jet. And the smell of a jet is just unbelievable. It's just a smell, it's like Marmite, you either love it or you hate it, and I loved it. Did the first initial part of the course on the 3, and then we went on to the slightly faster and more equipped 4. And at the end of that, I got my wings. They don't get the wings so early now, but I've been in the Air Force about 18 months, maybe a little bit longer, and I got my wings, which was the proudest day of my life, you know. I still got a pair somewhere, they're not RAF ones. Well, they are, actually. And my parents came up for that, and that was just a wonderful day. And then from there, we were streamed. And depending on how well you'd done on the course, you were either sent to RAF Valley, here just across the sea at Anglesey, or you were sent to RAF Oakington near Cambridge to fly the Varsity. So it was either that or the Varsity in those days. And I think places 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 went to Valley to fly the Nat. 11 to goodness knows where in the bowels of the earth went to Oakington. And me, for some reason, right down the back of the course, got sent to Valley, which was a real surprise, because I thought I was headed for Maltese. So I said to my instructor, why are you not sending me to Maltese? Like the rest of the guys around me said, no. You're going to kill anybody, kill yourself, not other people. Yeah, I hope he was joking. So I then came to Valley. As I say, it's only about 10 miles, 20 miles across the water, and flew the Nat, which was a fantabulous airplane. Oh, it's just a dream. And up until the 80s, it was my favourite airplane of all time, you know. It was responsive, it was fast, it was nimble, it was tiny. You strapped a Nat on. You didn't sit in a Nat, you pulled it on like a parachute and climbed in and away you went. And the rate of roll was phenomenal. It was about 360 degrees a second, which is fast. The Rad Arrows had a limiter taken out and they could do even more, which must have been amazing.
In this section, Phil talks about being streamed to Canberras.
I really wanted to go to the Hunter. That was always my sort of aim and my ambition. And I would have accepted the Lightning as an alternative, but no, I mean, they'd seen through me by this stage. My position on the course was never going to get me to a fast jet at that point in time. So I went to the PR Canberra, which was a bit of a bonus over the, I don't mean this unkindly, bomber guys, but Recce was always that cut above, you know, where the better guys went. And I know people are going to hate me for that. So I went to the Recce training school with the Canberra OCU at RAF Bassingbourne, again in Cambridge, which I enjoyed. But the Canberra is a different beast altogether. It's a tricky aeroplane to fly in certain conditions, especially asymmetric. And the Canberra's a bit of an unforgiving aircraft, as I'll probably say later on, that if you mistreated it or mishandled it, it was a killer on one engine. And I have lost a few of my friends by that very problem. So at the end of the Canberra course, and you know, the biggest problem I had on the Canberra was taxiing. I couldn't taxi out to the runway, and my instructor was tearing his hair out. And he said, Phil, if you can't taxi it, you can't take off, you can't go solo, so to speak, and you won't pass the course. And do you know something? I had a dream one night on how to taxi the Canberra. And I woke up in the morning, and it was a slightly different technique to what he was teaching me. Now, we had handbrakes, So you squeeze the brake and it slows you down, and then you applied a differential rudder to actually give you left or right braking on each wheel. And basically what I was doing is I was putting full rudder on, squeezing the brake, and then lurching left or right in a zigzag. So I dreamt, which was actually going back to the chipmunk technique, put a tiny bit of handbrake on, and then just feather the rudder. And I went out straight down the taxiway, straight round the corner, straight onto a threshold and took off. And my instructor said to me, "What the bloody hell happened there, Phil?" I said, "You're not going to believe it, but I dreamt on how to do it last night." He said, "Well, good for you, you know. That's the only time that's ever happened. I could have done with that help in the, you know, time's future, but that didn't occur." Anyway, I was posted to Germany on the PR7, which I was looking forward to, but my navigator, a guy called Jim Smith, was going to RAF Malta to fly the PR9, which, again, in terms of aircraft, the PR9 is the definitive Canberra in the Royal Air Force for sure. So I went to the postings people and I said, "Is there any chance I can join my navigator in Malta?" And they said, "Yeah, of course you can." So I went to Malta on 39 Squadron and had two wonderful years there flying the Canberra around the world. It was a dream job. And when I look back on why I joined the Air Force, to fly and see the world, it just ticked all the boxes. I mean, we went out to, I was very young, I was just over 21 really. And we went out, just the two of us went out to Kenya, self-supporting. There was an RAF detachment out there who helped us refueling and any problem and chocking the aircraft and things. But we did part of the survey of Kenya, which was just fantastic. And the weekend off, we obviously went up country and saw the safari wildlife. Oh, I was in heaven again. And we went out to Singapore quite a lot to photograph Borneo, do the survey of Borneo, which was marvellous. And we went out to Hong Kong and all over the world, and of course the Middle East and Europe as well. So just did an awful lot of travelling. In fact, one year I worked out I was away more often with my navigator than I was at home with the family, you know. And I mean, we would get regularly 400 hours a year, which in the modern Air Force is as much as some guys are getting almost in a tour, you know. So we did a lot of flying. And of course the PR9, if I can talk about the PR9 for a minute, I know I'm standing next to my beloved Hunter, but the PR9 was just a dream aeroplane. It was everything that the Canberra was and more. It had bigger engines, same engines that they used on the FGA-9, Rolls-Royce Avon 206, I think. It had hydraulic ailerons and rudder, which made it a lot easier to fly. It had a much bigger surface area wing. It was longer by about 4 feet in span, and it was also longer in depth, so it flew a lot higher. Whereas the ordinary Canberra would get up to about 49, 50, the PR9 would get to 60 plus. It had a very good suite of cameras to do the onboard filming. And of course it had an autopilot, which meant that when you went on these long flogs of 4 hours out to the Far East, you had an autopilot to take some of the strain away. And joy of joy, it had an opening canopy, which the other cameras didn't have. The other cameras had a bubble canopy and you got in through a door at the side, which meant that when it got hot, it was like a greenhouse, really hot. My first fighter squadron. Right. Can I just fill in the gaps then? I hope you don't mind. From there, I got sent to CFS, Flying Instructors, QF Fighter, where you saw the picture. I flew the Chipmunk at Birmingham UAS, and then later the Bulldog. I then, for various reasons, again tied into being academically challenged, I ended up on a ground tour at the Jaguar OCU RAF Lossiemouth. And I was a sim instructor there and ground school instructor. And I managed to bag as many trips in the back as I could on bombing sorties and formation and combat sorties. And I did about 40 hours. And one day the boss came into the crew room and there were two of us who were there. A guy was ex-Vulcans and myself ex-Cameras. And he said, "Do you two want to fly the Jaguar?" And we said, "How long have we got to think about it?" And he said, "Well, as long as you like." We said, "Yes, we do." And that was it. So he took the two of us and he put us on a mini course, and we did about three trips on the two-seater, and then he sent us solo in the single-seater, which again was why I got the Jaguar patch, because I flew it solo and you're entitled to it. And his plan was to circumnavigate, short circuit, if you like, the training system rather than go to tactical weapons unit. He said that the Jaguar was such a good aeroplane, and it was a very good trainer as well as fighter bomber. He could short circuit the system and take us through the OCU, spit us out the far end, straight into a Jaguar squadron. Brilliant. So he said, right, after solo, you'll do a bit of formation, bit of IF, bit of low level, and then we'll pick up the course from there. Someone obviously got wind of it higher up the chain and put a stop to it, and he came in and said, I'm not allowed to do it. Bruce Latton, that was, a great New Zealand wing commander. And so I went back to the simulator. Anyway, one day the group captain Caldwell came in and he said, Phil, I've got some good news for you. You're posted onto the TW, which for me was really lucky, because there were two TWs going at the time to try and pick up the backlog. One was down at Chivina on the, I think they had Hunters and Hawks, and the other was at Lossiemouth, which was on the FGA-9. And so I didn't have to move or anything. I just moved across the airfield to the Hunter, number two Hunter TW, and I did 6 months learning to fly the Hunter, tactically, combat, low level, and of course, the one thing I've always wanted to do since I joined the Air Force, weapons. So, got to fire the gun first of all, the Aiden, which, marvellous machine. You know what I was saying about the smell of jet fuel, kerosene? Well, the smell of cordite is even better. The smell of cordite wafting through the cockpit is just a high in some ways. So I fired the gun, which was great. Then you got to drop the practice bombs. Bombs. Yeah, I'm not really a great bomb fan. And then, of course, there's a Harrier next to us just across there, and we got to fire the Sneb rockets, the 88mm Sneb, which is just an awesome weapon. It went off virtually supersonic. In fact, I think it might have gone supersonic in the later stages of the flight, and you could actually follow it till it hit the target, so that was a joy. When I finished that course, there was another short hold, and so I said to the powers to be on the TW, how about I hold on the simulator, the 100 simulator, if you give me some freebie flying. So I'll do the job, and then we've got a spare jet or a spare trip. So they said fine. So I did another short period flying, continued to fly the FGA-9. And in fact, some of the air defense guys took me under their wing and said, come on, we'll teach you some of the stuff you've not done on the course, which is not just combat, but the geometry of air defense, interception. And actually, I enjoyed that, and I love combat. Combat is the sport of kings. And as much as I like low level, certainly from my Canberra days where I'd done a lot of it, combat, I've always felt, was where it's at. So although I was posted to the Jaguar, I asked if I could transfer to the Phantom. And again, they said, yep, that's fine. So I then went down to RAF Coningsby in about 1981 or late 80, and started on the Phantom OCU. And now to get to your, because I'm a QFI and I spent hours talking about the same question, but to get to your answer, my first one was the mighty 43 squadron at RAF Lucas. Yes. I was waiting for the building to erupt, but it's not going to. 43 squadron, is there a fighting cock in the house? You bet your sweet ass there is, you know. And of course, across the road was our sister squadron, and they were a sister squadron. They were a bunch of girls, you know, Treble One. And of course, the rivalry between fighter squadrons is just awesome. I mean, almost like two separate gangs, you know. But I love the Phantom. The Phantom, I've used the word beast about other aircraft, but the Phantom was just an animal. Just an animal. Again, an aircraft which you didn't treat with respect, it would bite you in the ball. Great at medium speed and high speed. It was a very effective weapon platform. Four sidewinders, four Sparrow stroke Sky Flash, and the Gatling gun underneath. So it was a good weapon. But when you started to get slow, because of all, it wasn't designed by any known aerodynamicist I know. It had anhedral, it had dihedral, it even had a touch of cathedral in it, I'm sure it did, because it flew like one at times. And if you got slow and you put the wrong inputs in, you couldn't use aileron at low speed because of that adverse aileron yaw. And there were all sorts of things going on with it. But you had to use rudder. So you rolled the aircraft using secondary effects of roll, of yaw rather, which would be roll. And I remember doing a trip with a test pilot from America, and he didn't believe me, and he said, can I see how it works? And I said, it's tricky. He said, no, I'll be fine, I'm a test pilot. So we went up to height, and I said, right, you have control. So we brought it back to very slow, threw in a whole bunch of stick, and this Phantom just departed in about a millisecond into this tumbling mass of ironmongering. So I knew it was going to do it, so I took control, recovered it. And he went, bloody hell, he said, that should never have been released to service. And he said as much when I went to his presentation in Boscombe Down. He gave a presentation on the Phantom, and he said, this aircraft would not be released to service these days because his handling characteristics were awful. It's not my favourite aircraft because it is so, you've got to be on the ball all the time. It's not an aircraft you can relax and enjoy. A bit like driving an early 911 Porsche, you know, too much throttle or too much steering wheel and you're off the road. And the Phantom was just like that. Now, you were asking earlier about my favourite aircraft. Well, my favourite aircraft is this girl here. This is the Hunter F1, which is a fairly rare beast these days. 1947, 49, it was conceived, I suppose, on paper. Started to go into prototypes in 1951, and eventually saw service as a fighter in about 1953. This one first went to 54 Squadron, and then to the Day Fighter Leadership School, and it's a good beast. The more modern Hunters have got a lot of extras. They've got more wet points for carrying fuel and weapons. The six is strengthened, bigger engines, and then of course you've got the definitive Hunter, the FGA-9, which has got the Avon 200 series engine, which was about 10,000 pounds of thrust, which is actually, strangely, the same engine that they used in the cameras as well. I think the PR-7 had the early 200s, and the PR-9 had the uprated 11.25 engines in the 206, I think, or 207. And so that was Saga Hunter. Into service in early 53, and then Neville Duke took it to the world airspeed record in September 53, I think it was, at 727 mile an hour, which is shifted. But the nice thing about the Hunter was, it wasn't supersonic in a straight line. It was only supersonic in a dive. But if you got a Hunter up to speed at low level, it made the most fantastic sound called the Blue Note. And that was the noise that the air whistling through the gun ports would howl. It was a banshee of a noise. And I can remember taking one across RAF Lugas one day just to show the Phantom boys that this is what a real jet sounds like. And it was a beautiful airplane. The nine bigger engines, I say, tail shoot, strengthened wings again, uprated air conditioning system, and more oxygen. So it was a much more capable jet. And I think there was something like 122 FGA-9s. And of course, it was in service all around the world with the Indians, the Swedes, and the Swiss, mainly. And then I think some like 27 other countries flew the Hunter. The Lebanese flew it right up until only about 2 or 3 years ago when they finally retired it. The Navy had, and the Air Force had a couple of T-78s, which they used for training crews on the Buccaneer and for training crews on the Harrier. So it saw service, certainly with the Air Force for over 30 years and with overseas for over 50 years, and it really is a wonderful airplane. Now, my dad worked in the car industry, and he said, never buy a car that's just come off the production line, a new model. He said, always buy it as it gets to the end of its life, because that's when it gets good. And he's dead right about airplanes as well. The FGA-9 or the FR-10, his recce equivalent was, superb. The Canberra PR-9, superb. Now the Americans took the PR-9 and they turned it into the B-57, the RB-57F and the B-57G, which had tandem cockpit seating, were just excellent productions of a stalwart aircraft. So that's the Hunter. I have no incidences in all my time on the Hunter, so I can't tell you any real good stories about it, except I like to think of airplanes sometimes as cars. And if you said to me, what's the Hunter like? I'd say it was a bit like driving something like a Jaguar E-Type. You know, not perfect, a bit clunky in places, you know, panels perhaps didn't fit as well as they could, rattled and rolled over bumps. But when you got the hang of an E-Type, it was just a joy to drive. And I think the FJ9 is the sort of the aviation equivalent of an E-Type. I was also lying in bed the other night thinking, well, what would the others be? I was trying to think of aircraft type for the Phantom and the Tornado. The Tornado was a funny airplane to fly. It was a very good weapon system, very good radar, certainly towards the end. Rubbish at the beginning, but good at the end. It was very capable, it had some good kit on board and some good tactics. But technology dilutes the experience, no doubt about it, both in cars and in aeroplanes. If you're flying through a computer, you're not going to get the same feedback and feel as if you're flying, you know, almost directly linked to the controls. So I can't say I ever really, really loved flying the Tornado. I enjoyed operating it, but flying it, no, it wasn't a pilot's delight. Friends of mine, I did have one trip in the Lightning, which I thought was a hoot. A friend of mine in Singapore said, come on, we'll go up and we'll show you what the Lightning did. And that was just a blast from start to finish, literally a blast. And I had a trip in an F-16. Now, again, you've got two aircraft, very similar roles, air defense, close air support, that sort of stuff. Combat. And the F-16, yeah, with a little side stick there. Yeah, couldn't take to it. Just felt that I wasn't in control. I enjoyed it, don't get me wrong. It was a lovely, lovely airplane to fly, but the Lightning, you know, you are connected to everything and it just makes, you know, you make it do what you want to do. So there we are. That's about most things I've flown, really.
Phil gives a tour of the Hunter cockpit.
My gum, this takes me back. The smell. Oh, it's just got a smell all of its own. It's gorgeous. Maybe it's old bits of leather or old bits of charred wiring, or I don't know. The thing about the Hunter was that when they introduced a mod, you would have a panel here which would have switches which would be added as a post mod, and it could have up for rockets and down for judges and fuel tanks, and on the next aircraft you could have up for judges and fuel tanks and down for rockets. And there have been quite a few times on the range where guys have selected what they thought was rockets, pressed the pickle button, and fuel tanks dropped off. So the Hunter became a bit of an ergonomic nightmare, but it was a wonderful aircraft. As I say, its big limitation was fuel, especially without the slipper tanks. And there was a very sad case, I think it was the late 50s, where a squadron of Hunters were going back to an East Anglian airfield. The weather was poor. They couldn't get in. I think it was West Raynham, actually, and they had to divert. Well, I think 8 of them diverted. 6 crashed and 1 guy died, and it was known as Black Friday, and it's one of the worst days in the Air Force. So, but as you can see, it's got no nav aids at all in there. I'm just looking around. It's got all the standard flying instrument panel. It's got a compass, which is nice. It would have had a stopwatch there, a Monte Carlo stopwatch. And basically navigation was just compass, speed, watch and map. And that's all you did. And you just flew around at low level, just with those very primary and basic instruments, using techniques which go back to sailing days. But I know someone, a chap in Australia, was asking, how do you navigate a low-level aircraft on your own at those sort of speeds? Well, you're doing, in this aircraft, about 420 knots at low level, which is 7 miles a minute, which is quick. But the thing is, you don't start at 7 miles a minute. You start on a chipmunk, which is 90 knots, mile and a half a minute, and so on. Then you go into the Jet Provost, which is probably 4 miles a minute. Then you go onto the Hawk, which is probably 6 miles a minute. maybe 7 miles a minute, and then you come on to the Hunter, which may be seven, and then later on, of course, in the typhoon, or sorry, in the tornado, you could be doing a lot quicker, as much as 9 miles a minute, something like that. So you start off slowly, like riding a bike, like ice skating, whatever. It's a skill you learn. The other thing is, as you get faster, you look for bigger objects ahead. So instead of looking for a farm a mile or two ahead, you're looking for a mast maybe 5-6 miles ahead. So you're looking for big objects, hopefully with some vertical extent, something that's fairly unique. If you've got an area with a lot of masts, then you don't choose a mast. You might choose a railway junction or a lake or something like that. And from that major point, you can then say, from that lake, I can find a river intersection. From that river intersection, I can then find a footbridge or a railway crossing, whatever, and that's my target for the day. So you start off big, and you like cone it in until you're down to the very narrow stuff. Now, mental dead reckoning is something you get used to. There are tricks of the trade using the 1-in-60 rule. So if you're a mile off in 30 miles, you know what the error is, you know how to correct. And that's probably because of wind error. So you correct for that in the opposite direction.
Phil talks about flying against the F-14s and the F-18s of the US Navy.
One thing which I know I told you about was flying against the US Navy and their F-14s and their F-18s. In March 89, we went out with a detachment from the OCU of Tornadoes to Akrotiri in Cyprus. And we were there for our APC, Armament Practice Camp, where we learned to qualify NATO standard on the gun. And so we went out there. While we were there, often we would get in touch with US Navy headquarters and say, do you want to do some dissimilar combat with your guys off the carrier? And in 89, I think the USS Theodore Roosevelt was out there, which is a big Nimitz class, number 4 in its class, called the Big Stick, and that was out there. And they said, will you work with the F-14s and F-18s? So we said, yeah, we'll be delighted. Well, it was an unfair fight, really. The Tornado, 4 Tornadoes against 2 of those F-14s and 2 F-18s was never going to work. Our tactics were good, but the Americans, obviously, they had the Phoenix missile, 100 mile over the horizon, vertical down, Mach 5, was going to wipe you out. So we tried to ignore them or agree that the rules of combat were that once they'd fired their Phoenix, we were then close to close quarters. And of course, the F-18 was a wonderful close quarter aircraft. And we held our own, but I wouldn't say with any huge success. I feel a bit more disappointed about that flying than my navigator, who seems to remember it with slightly more rose-tinted spectacles than I do. But the following year, we went out in the April of 90 with a detachment of students because we were behind because of the bad weather. So we went out with our students, and while we were there, we said to the US Navy, would you like to do some more DACT? And they said, yes, please. 14s and 18s off the Midway class, Pearl Harbor, that's right. So we've got a detachment of Hawks out with us, acting as targets, which is a cost-effective way of generating extra targets. So we went in what we know as MFF, Mixed Fighter Force. So there would be 2 Tornadoes, and 2 Hawks, 1 Tornado with a Hawk on its wing against 2 14s and 2 18s. So day one, we went in, and what we would do is that we would find the targets on our radar, tell the Hawks where they were, drive as fast as the Hawks could go till they were close and they could see the 14s and 18s. Once they were tally, we would then plug in the burners, fire our Fox 1s at Sky Flash, and we would run away safely to about 12 miles. And then come back. The Hawks, I think the Hawks like a Jack Russell Terrier. Small, tenacious, aggressive, and it was snapping at the heels of the 14s and 18s and tying them up. And of course the Hawk had the AIM-9 Lean-ROM as well, which was a good weapon. So it was getting its own share of kills. We would then go out to 12 miles, turn round, come back in, lock up, and in the target designator box in the head-up display, if you could see the target, it was a big target, therefore it was a 14 or an 18. If you couldn't see the target, it was a Hawk, so you broke the lock and locked to one that you could see. You'd then shoot that in the face with a Fox 1, and then we'd run away bravely and do the same again. So at the end of the day, 4-0 to the Brits, Americans lose. Terrific. Next day, we decided that the Americans wouldn't stick for this. They would probably do something different. So we decided, well, I didn't decide, but the Fred, who was the QI in charge, decided that we would come in 10 miles split, one Hawk, one Tornado, 10 miles apart, rather than normally 3 to 5 miles visually. We were 10 miles laterally separated, and we would come in on a slight angle, which meant whichever package the Americans turned towards, they turned towards them, and therefore the other package was free, and they just came up behind them and shot him in the tail with their sidewinders or whatever. At the end of that day, Brits 4, Americans 0, tick in the box, go home. Day 3, new tactic, Americans came up 10 miles split. Surprise, surprise. We were now 20 miles split, which meant that when the Americans then tried to commit to package A or package B, the other package was then free to go and wreak havoc in their 6 o'clock, which is what we did again. Again, 4-0 to the Brits, and that was a much better detachment. The big thing about the Americans is, and I was saying in this book I'm writing, the Russians, is that they're very much more constrained to the tactics that they brief. They don't think as freely, or they're not as loud, not allowed to be as maneuverable and tactical inclined as the Brits were. And so although they were on a steep learning curve, we were one step ahead of them all the time. So of course, Friday night, we landed 4-0. So that was, 12-0 for the week. We went to the bar and enthused our students with tales of derring do. And of course, the bar, beer, the Americans dry ship, they lose again, don't they? So I'd rather be in the Royal Air Force. And who wants to land on an aircraft carrier in the middle of the night when it's blowing a gale? No, thank you. So that was tactical deployment using dissimilar combat. Of course, as NATO, we flew against everything. We flew against Mirage 3s, Mirage bombers, 5s. I can't even think now. Everything that's in the inventory, F-15s, F-14s, A-10s, F-111s. Do you know, I'm a very lucky person. I think anybody who's flown in the Air Force, whether it's helicopters or transport, they've all got their tales to tell. They've all got their pleasures of rescuing people or taking aid into relief into a country. Anybody who joins the military, I think, has got themselves a terrific career. It's not probably gone that way recently with things like Afghanistan, which has brought a lot of heartache. And I appreciate there is a downside to every conflict. But me in particular, and my fighter friends, think we probably have the best of the Air Force. And we are very lucky people indeed. And I'm very grateful for having been allowed to do it, you know.
Phil tells us about his upcoming book, Patrolling the Cold War Skies.
You forced me to talk about the book, which I'm very, very reluctant to do. I know there are certain other authors that talk about nothing else but their book, but my book is still a work in progress at the moment. It started about 23 years ago, writing down a few sort of memories of what went on during my flying career, sort of anecdotes, riffing yarns, if you like. And then I met an author who persuaded me to actually get more of a grip with it, which I did, and then I put it on the back burner. And it was about 18 months ago, when I left work, that I decided it was time to get the book from off the back boiler and get it going again. So for the last 18 months, I've been writing the book. I'm up to about 105,000 words now, which is good. They're just really extracts of stories like you've heard today, and a whole load more, which I've just put down in print, with some nice photographs done by a friend of mine, an aviation photographer. And I did have a book deal going with a major publishing company, but when I saw the contract, I thought it probably wasn't as equitable as I would have liked, so we've gone our own separate ways. So if there are any publishers out there that want a really good rattling read, it's funny, it's thrilling, it's poignant in places when I start talking about people who are no longer with us or incidences that were really nasty, and It's in about its fifth iteration at the moment. It started off, I think I'm about the sixth rewriting of it. And the trouble is, as I was saying to you earlier, you put it down for a month, you pick it up and you read it again and think, who wrote this rubbish, you know? The English is poor, but it's getting better slowly. I've probably got two more rewrites before it's anywhere near ready to be sent to a publisher again, seriously. And so that's what I'm working on at the moment. So I normally have a splurge for about 6 weeks, about 5 hours a day, then put it down for a month or two, let my brain cool down, go back and look at it with fresh eyes, and start the whole process again. I think we're just coming up to the X-List at the moment, which those of you who know the Tornado Radars, wasn't a very good list. So I've just got the Y and the Z to go. Once I've done that, then I'll either self-publish it, or I've already put bits on Facebook, on the Phantom and the Tornado websites on Facebook, and one or two other places. And it's been well received. I've sent it to all sorts of people. My dentist, a farmer friend, my son who's a teacher, even the ladies. So I've tried to send it to a wide selection of people. A lot of my military friends have read sections from it and contributed, as they remember things that I've forgotten. So I'm trying to appeal. You've got Dave Gledhill, who does the very excellent technical side, with some tales. And then you've got other books, which I won't mention the authors, but they're a bit sort of flowery, a bit poetic, a bit prosaic. Mine is sort of the sort of stories you would tell after a couple of beers in the bar on a Friday night, when you go, do you remember when we were doing this? So I'm hoping it will meet both needs. I've also put a lot of technical stuff in. It started off at about 70,000, but I decided it needed some more technical stuff for the enthusiasts. So I've taken that in two directions, a bit more about the aircraft and the missiles and what they're capable of, and also a bit more about the Cold War. Because as I was writing it towards the end, I suddenly realised what a massive thing the Cold War was, really. Even though we trained for every day of the week with exercises and so on, you sort of blotted a lot of it out, really. It's the only way you could survive. But of course the Cold War was there. It was the elephant in the room, every day, all day, 24/7. Certainly when you were on QRA it was. And so I've put a lot more about the Cold War in and the implications of that. So that's the book. I'm sorry you had to force me to part with that, but there you are. I hope it'll be out, or certainly find a publisher in the autumn. And I was hoping for Christmas, but that's too soon. So maybe Easter next year. Buy one.
And finally, we get a more personal side to Phil.
I'm a member of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, and I'm an ops manager for them. A bit like being QRA commander. I'm on the end of a pager, and when a 999 call comes in, they speak to the Coast Guard, who then pages me. I speak to the Coast Guard directly, and then I give him permission to send the page out to the rest of the crew as to which boat we're going to launch, whether we're going to launch the big boat or the inshore. And then once that boat's launched, I go down and I do the management side of things, the paperwork, keep an eye on the weather, keep an eye on the early days about whether we're going to go and refuel. So that takes up sometimes, if we're short-handed, as we were a couple of months ago, 2, 3, 4 days a week. Now we've got almost back to a full complement, and so it's probably 1 or 2 days a week, 24-hour shift, you know, on the pager. So I do that. I've got 5 dogs, 4 Jack Russells, who are a laugh, and a Labrador, who's a soft thing. She runs around other dogs barking to distract their attention while the Jack Russells get stuck in and nip at their hind legs. So that takes a lot of walking. I play a bit of golf occasionally. I gave it up for a long time, but I just started again. I play table tennis twice a week now, because I was just, I had to lose a bit of weight. So I played table tennis. I was very involved with the church for many years. Well, I still am to an extent. And so basically, you know, I've tried to fit in with the local community in North Wales. And of course I've got family as well that take up some of that time. And I love reading. We do a lot of reading.
Do you have a favourite kid?
Favourite tipple? Oh yes. Oh yes. I love real ale. I love Jennings, Best Bitter. I love Timothy Taylor Landlord. If anybody from Timothy Taylor's watching, I'll send you my postcode because, you know, there's a plug. I like Bateman's from Lincolnshire. Some of their beers were fabulous. So yes, I like real ale. And there's been a couple of breweries that have started in North Wales since I've been there, which are brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. Do you know, it's funny, I was thinking about one of the things I did that when I decided that I was going to join the Air Force and leave the police force, whether they were trying to persuade me to stay in or what, I don't know, but my last 3 months I was seconded to CID, which was a completely different to the rest of the police force. I'm regimented both in uniform and in attitude. And I think CID was more like dealing with aircrew than dealing with a normal body. And I think I would have probably wanted to go back into the police force. At one stage, they were looking for superintendents in Hong Kong with people with ex-service commissions. And I seriously thought about going out to Hong Kong as a police superintendent because I love Hong Kong as well. And I thought, yeah, this could be fun, dealing with the drug triads and that sort of stuff, boys' own stuff. But I had a family then, so I didn't go. So, yeah, I probably would have gone back into the police force because it's a good life, it's an honourable life in the main, and I enjoyed the freedom and the flexibility of CID. Yeah. Yeah.
So, do you ever get sick of talking about aviation?
No, I don't. No, once it's in your bloodstream, it's. Like hepatitis C or something like that, you can't get rid of it. It lingers with you until death. And so although a lot of my friends at the moment are civilian, what I call civilians, they're not aviation people, I still talk to some of my friends on Facebook, and occasionally we get together in reunions and go down the pub and have a few beers. And of course the sole topic of conversation is flying and incidences and accidents. So no, I love talking about flying. I wish I could do more of it, but sadly, my wife is bored to death with it, so I don't do a lot of it at home. That's for sure.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it, and don't forget to visit our YouTube site where you can watch Phil's and everyone else's interview at youtube.com/aircrewinterview. Thank you.